What is peace? What do we mean when we use that word?
How can there be peace if there's no peace in my home, if I can't feed my children and send them to school? That there's no death toll for that kind of war, that kind of conflict that women experience in their own homes.
In the spring of 2019, live artist and theatre director Neil Bartlett spent 6 months crisscrossing the country, seeking out and interviewing 100 remarkable peace workers.
Killing does not end killing. Killing does not end killing. You can test it anywhere where people have been killing. Has it ended killing?
What is peace? Is it what you get when a war is over and flags get waved and politicians make promises? Or is it a long and highly risky personal slog to make people understand that we don't have to be at war before we start talking about and working towards a culture that values dignity and freedom from fear, regardless of where you happen to live or be from? Or to put it another way, is peace actually action as opposed to some kind of utopia? The people you're about to hear all have individual stories, but share one thing: an unapologetic sense that using the word peace doesn't make you a dreamer, a fantasist, or a loser.
I am somebody who grew up in northern Uganda. It's very difficult to change things that have lasted for 12 years. But the best we are able to do is tell the story. The responsibility is to tell the story to the world.
Caesar is a project manager for Conciliation Resources East and Central Africa Programme.
What peace means to me is go in the morning, walk for about a half a kilometer, go to school, come back home. In the dry season, you go hunting, you go swimming in the river, come back home. During springtime, the fruits growing. During Christmas time, we kind of eat chicken once in a year, and we're looking forward to Christmas time. That's what peace meant for me. But then, when I was here in London, I hear that place is no more. That kind of thing is no more. Oh. My mom used to encourage me to grow tomato, potatoes, and I used to have my own animals. To me, peace was that.
Can you tell me your journey, and how were you hearing about the suffering that was underneath the government story? Kind
of family members who were actually abducted. My wife, my late wife, her sister was actually taken from school by the LRA. And because she had resisted along the way, she actually got killed. It affected me personally, living with somebody whose sister was actually killed. We grew up together. But when my own family started calling me, for 10 years, people have been suffering. Somebody's lips has been cut. Somebody has been abducted in school. In northern Uganda, children were being abducted to go to the bush, come and commit atrocities to their own communities. So they simply said, "You guys in London, in Europe, why don't you help us?" Yeah, so for me, northern Uganda then became my obligation. Everybody wanted a hopeful Uganda. But people in northern Uganda were suffering. For 10 years, people have been suffering. It would be irresponsible for us not to tell the story to the world. Let's try to help these people change their narrative of this conflict. In Europe, if I showed you the picture of Berlin after the Second World War and the picture of Berlin 35 years after, when there was no war, you would not want to get anywhere near the gun. Killing never ends killing, and we would like peace. What drives me is I want the children of northern Uganda to experience the kind of life I experienced, the kind of freedom, what peace meant to me then.
There are now children who are able to have what you felt was their human right to have. But where are we now in 2019?
Yeah.
Let's imagine we go to Entebbe, then we go to Gulu.
Yeah.
What would you show me?
I would like to drive you from Kampala to northern Uganda. Gulu is one of the fastest growing town now in northern Uganda. And you will see very early in the morning or in the evening an antelope crossing the road, an elephant just grazing by the river, gorillas are actually coming to your car to get some bananas. And then when you get home, you are welcome, my honey, people with whom you studied, people who took care of you. That kind of atmosphere and the cultural dance that we actually do here is a kind of ceremony that people we do on an annual basis now in northern Uganda.
My feeling of peace is increasingly sort of connected to justice, feeling safe to be me, and I can voice opinions publicly without any sort of violent backlash or things like that.
Serena is a gender advisor at the Foreign Office, working as part of the Cabinet Office, overseeing the spending of the $1 billion plus Conflict Stability and Security Fund, a fund which is meant to be spent on peace building as well as peacekeeping. Previously, she worked for ActionAid and as Director of Gender Action for Peace and Security.
So this £1.3 billion is being spent in the pursuit of peace. A big chunk of it goes to support the UN peacekeeping budget. Relatively tiny pots of money of £500,000 that goes to take forward some sort of peace-building project to prevent conflict. And whoever has that money, I want to make sure that they are using that money to support women. Women who are affected by conflict, women who are working to end or prevent that conflict, build positive peace, who are advocating for women's rights.
Tell me more about the idea of gender mainstreaming.
Even if you aren't, if your project is not specifically about women's participation in the peace talks, by gender mainstreaming, that means you are looking at the gendered differences and ideally the sort of gendered causes of any sort of conflict. Why is it that most participants of armed violence are men? What is it about them as men that caused them to either pick up a gun or there's expectation that they will join an armed group, the military, an armed resistance? If you sort of escalate it to societal level expectations around gender, around what it means to be a man, about what it means to be a woman, it's not societally normal or accepted in many places for women to carry a weapon, particularly where it's acceptable for men to. So there's differences around gender in that respect. You know, it sort of becomes embedded in your identity as a man, as a masculine figure, to be willing to defend your country or your cause and so on. So that, for me, is an example of a gender driver of conflict, right? Your ideal societal ideals around being a man and being a masculine man can be manipulated for the purpose of escalating conflict. And actually vice versa, that women can be used and ideals around femininity and womanhood can be used to escalate conflict, whether it's to provide food or shelter for armed groups, particularly if they're like, you know, opposition type groups, militia groups. Some women definitely are recruited into armed groups. And that again, and actually we're seeing it now with Islamic State and kind of using the rhetoric around gender equality and opportunities to enhance your status in society by adopting ideals that are that have privilege, right? Because that's what we mean by male privilege. It's qualities, ideals, attributes that are designated as being better, and therefore you know, reap some benefit from that. So if you as a woman can be more like a man, that'll work out better for you. And I think we forget as well the generational impact of war and conflict, and I suppose that's sort of traditionally as well how we might understand it. That still kind of lives on for everybody, but can live on for women and girls in very different ways, particularly where they might have been subjected to sexual violence or denied education or forcibly married at such young ages.
Does war only mean war? Is it only a war if it's armed forces between nation states?
Women that had lived through war as we might traditionally understand it, two or more sides, guns, people dying as a result of that, and even where those guns were laid down and peace deals were signed, women were saying, like, this isn't peace for me, and that conflict doesn't have to mean just the presence of armed conflict or violence perpetrated by soldiers or combatants or anything like that. If you look below that kind of level, like right down to the communities, women aren't living in peace. They're not safe. Because if you're not safe in your home, where can you be safe? And so much of women's history is completely, like, invisibilised and marginalised because the kinds of roles that they have typically played just aren't valued. Compared to men that are, like, lay down their guns, they get so much acknowledgement for that and praise. And particularly the men that seemingly are able to convince them to do that, whether they're in conflict area themselves or in the UN or wherever, they get so much recognition. And actually, the kinds of roles that women have been able to play because of societal restrictions just aren't valued, so no one tells their story.
If somewhere someone is in pain, the rest of human beings should be in pain.
Almas is frontline services manager for Asylum Welcome Oxford. He's a former gun-carrying, left-wing, political Kurdish dissident from Iran, and so has personal experience of being on the sharp end of asylum seeking himself.
There is a long history. Of course, different people have different opinion about this. There's a long history in this country where we welcome those people who flee persecution, hardship, war, and help them, harbouring them when they were in need. And also, we live in 21st century, and therefore, if there is a need somewhere in other part of the world, and if someone is in pain, as human being, we need to have that feeling. I do not think individual or communities are born racist or pro-asylum. We grow in an environment, and our brain or behavior or character shaped within the family, right from beginning, and in wider societies. There are so many things that may have an impact: hardship, isolation, being ignored, seeing things differently, being misled and confused by media, are all different elements to become pro or against asylum. And my understanding is immigration in this country has been played by politics. If we take away immigration from politics and say immigration is a matter of worldwide consideration, and I don't know how a human being with that sort of understanding could respond to other human beings knocking your door and say, I need to be protected, I need shelter, I need food, and you say, sorry, no, we don't have a space, you are not welcome. But majority of people in this country are not racist. Majority of these people in this country are for protecting, defending, and supporting people who are at risk, whether they are minor, whether they are women, children. I am Kurdish from Iran. I was in the region in Middle East for many years. I wanted to take what I learned and to make our society better in terms of peace, in terms of security, in terms of justice. But the government we had in power wouldn't let me. And they killed tens of thousands of people like myself. People who never ever touched a gun. People who never ever confronted anyone. They were just on the other side of politics, and the Iranian regime killed them. So that was the reason I had to leave the country. Saddam, I was in Iraq when Saddam was in power. So I had to leave that part of the world and end up in this country. Right now, if it happened that country changed, because I have learned so much in this part of the world, I would go back tomorrow. Not because I love that country, but because I want to contribute toward developing, towards building up a better society. That's my mission. If you are a human being who is in need of security, if you need shelter, if you live in uncertainty, if you are confused, if you are desperate for help, you go like a bird in a rain will go anywhere just to run away from that. You may end up in the wrong place, but when you are desperate, you do it.
Would you call this country peaceful?
I don't believe in absolute peace. Yes, there is a peace in this country. People can talk and do things, but still conflict emerge in a peaceful way in terms of human rights, in terms of becoming a better society, a society that provide sanctuary, provide peace, provide security, not only for us, for those who are in need.
Caesar, Zarina, Almas are just a few of the 100 remarkable voices who are part of my marathon performance, 24 Hours of Peace. Broadcast live on Resonance FM on Sunday, the 10th of November, Remembrance Sunday, 2019. 24 Hours of Peace is an act of witness to the work of peace, challenging received ideas and creating space for different stories and different voices to be heard on that day. You can find out more on the website www.24hoursofpeace.co.uk.